Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 28th of August. It's 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. We do welcome your... We're booting up as we speak. We welcome your comments, and it's very simple. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot of things to talk about. And, of course, one of the things is the unfolding situation in Texas, the what was Hurricane Harvey, now a tropical storm, continuing to wreak havoc on that state. Houston getting slammed, other places along the coast and inland as well, also under heavy, heavy flooding. And it is the simplest word I can think of is a mess. And we'll talk about that and some other issues this morning, as well as evacuation and the president's response. And then we'll get into some of the stories that broke on Friday evening, because Friday's always good for a couple good Trump stories, isn't it? And this Friday was no exception to that rule. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She is a communications consultant, joins us most every week, and we're thrilled to have her today. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad
How
to be
are you?
Here.
Very nice to have you with us. The Albany County District Attorney is with us. We are more than a little honored to have him with us. David Soares is here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm great, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to share my voice.
Well, thank you for coming and sharing your voice with us. We've enjoyed working with your agent and getting you in here, and it's very nice. We appreciate you being here. It adds nice credibility to our program. I thank you very much. Alan Chartok is here, and good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. Heavy weekend. We went to Roselle's 55th high school graduation.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that in Hudson?
It was in Hudson. It was. And Samuel Shemp, who wrote the inimitable House of God. It's a book. If you haven't read The House of God, there is no doctor in the world who has not read this hysteria. It is to medicine what the MASH was to the army. It just debunks it all. Did you say ball four?
It's like ball four.
No, I didn't like that book. So
sorry. Debunk the mystique, though.
Joe is just shaking his head back and
forth. Oh my! That was nice.
It was great. It was really wonderful.
How large of a class did Roselle have?
Well, it's getting less.
And they Quincy graduated.
I don't know when she graduated. You know, a long time ago, 55 years.
No, but I was wondering, like, how big the class was. Like, I graduated from a class of 800.
Really?
Yeah, so it's a very large school.
I have no idea.
So when they have...
I have no idea.
Okay, all right.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's fine.
But I'm really, I'm limited in the breadth of my knowledge.
Do you remember, like, Cohoes, what did you all graduate?
76 in my class.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes in around where I live, it's like 35, 40 kids, so... Yeah.
How about you, David?
Alan, I think you get credit for just providing transportation and being available. I think you get credit for that.
Yeah. Yeah. How many were in your class?
I don't recall.
You don't know either.
I came from a very small high school in Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, all right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, Pawtucket.
They raise a lot of chickens around
baseball.
Here, right?
Yeah.
Pawtucket
Reds.
Pawtucket Reds and the
Somebody's
Red Sox.
Trying to steal their team.
You know, we're moving downtown from McCoy Stadium, and the plan, I understand, is to move to downtown Pawtucket, so it's only a few blocks.
That stadium is one of the most interesting stadiums in the world, because they have this thing where if you're a kid and you want to get a ball signed by the players, you put the ball in a bucket. And then you take a rope, and you let the rope down.
Oh,
and then the players come by. They take the ball out of the bucket, right?
Yep.
And then they sign
yep.
it, and then they put it back in the bucket, and then you bring the bucket up.
That's great.
It's one of the traditions, in addition to learning how to be disappointed very early on.
You mean because you live there?
Because you're a Red Sox fan.
Red Sox fan.
Oh, I see.
It's gotten better, but still.
Two and a half games. The Yankees are out 2.5 games now.
That means the Red Sox are up 2.5 games.
That's right, but a couple of days ago they were up more than that.
Yeah, but they're still up 2.5 games.
I like your interpretation better. I appreciate your interpretation better than Alan's.
So while we're on minor league ball, there was a fun thing that happened Friday night in Erie, Pennsylvania. They had the, you know, these minor league teams have different promo nights to try to get people to come.
Yeah.
So they had alternative facts night. It was so funny. And on their scoreboard, they said, you know, here's a wall, but we've paid for this one. And they raffled off a basket of deplorables, a basket with, you know, all this mothballs and stuff like
that's
that.
That's just having fun, isn't
it? It was fantastically fun.
No, but it has a political meaning. It's very important.
Sure.
It did, but
fun.
It was humorous. And they had pictures in advance of this throngs of people arriving. You know, it was pictures of other events where there was long lines.
That's just creative.
It was
I love stuff
fun.
Like that. And you know, minor ballparks are the places where families can still enjoy a night out together and not break the bank.
That's right. So affordable, it's very nice.
It was fun. Anyway, there you go. Alternative facts night.
All right. We have our panel in place. Let us start and begin with the stories, of course. As I mentioned, the main story having to do with Harvey bringing catastrophic flooding to Houston. At least 5 reported dead. There was a press conference this morning with both FEMA and the governor of Texas. No new numbers have come out. And dozens of injuries have been reported in the aftermath of the storm that tore across the Gulf Coast of Texas over the weekend. On Sunday, the system, now a tropical storm, pounded the region with torrential rains that were expected to continue for days, causing catastrophic floods, according to the National Hurricane Center. One of the things about the storm that is so troubling is that this system just seems to be stalled, and the way I heard it described, I believe, as last night, was that it's at a walking pace, and it's just sort of very, very, very slowly making its way. So this rain, there is no let up of that for the people. So as they're dealing with the flooding right now, that situation just continues to get worse. We were told this morning from the press conference that the water is not exposed to perhaps not crest for 2 or 3 more days, which is greatly troubling.
70 inches, I heard.
The forecast rainfall of 15 to 25 inches through Friday top of what else is there. Mm-hmm. So that is the situation. And there have been very powerful pictures that we have seen. There's been very powerful video of people being rescued, of people not being able to be rescued, of the water just inundating these people in their homes. And everyone is saying the same thing, that this is unprecedented. This is a once in a 500-year flood. And it is something that everybody is trying to, obviously, to take care of who is out there, but then also further down to figure out what happened, what could have been done differently. And while I don't want to do a whole lot of Monday morning quarterbacking today, one of the questions, of course, is the evacuation order or the lack thereof in the city of Houston.
Well, there's precedent here. When there have been past storms and they did order evacuation, it caused a certain amount of chaos on the roads. The mayor is defending himself by saying that. The other thing is that I'm fascinated by what we as Americans expect. When Sandy came here, we expected that the rest of the country would be with us. And we had some disappointments in terms of the political apparatus and what they were going to do. To me, the name of the game as people move, our son was in Houston for 3 years running Teach for America, our son Jonas. And we spent a lot of time in Houston. Gorgeous city, really nice. We had a good, great time there. It just really breaks your heart. So there's this movement now in and out of cities. People come from Pawtucket to Albany, and from Albany they go to other places. And now we're sort of getting to the point where we are all you know, one country, Trump, from his perspective, has a real problem here. If he goes, they're going to take all kinds of people to have to protect him, people who could be out there, you know, taking care of people. On the other hand, if he doesn't go, he gets the rap for not going. So how does he mitigate that? Those are all questions.
Right now, plan to go tomorrow. David?
Well, going tomorrow to me is a non-starter, and the administration should really rethink that proposition. As you mentioned earlier, this is unlike any storm that's ever been witnessed in this country, because the clouds are there. This storm is staying over Houston, and it will continue to pour. They say another. It's like an inch every hour. And then this morning, I understand they also released some additional water from the two dams that they have there. So this is a city that is in turmoil. And right now, the focus for the first responders has to be saving people and getting people out of there, and not devoting some of their resources to make sure that the president is protected and safe.
So as a DA, my question to you is, what's the law and order aspect of this? There are always some people who take advantage of other people's misery.
There's going to be a lot of people who, of course, take advantage of this opportunity. But I think the first responders in that region of the country right now, their number one priority is saving lives. I mean, it's getting people off of their rooftops. It's checking in on the more vulnerable areas within their community, your senior housing. That's going to be their number one priority. And the looting is going to come second. They'll address those issues when it's appropriate.
From both FEMA and from the governor this morning of Texas saying that the first responders now are so taxed, and there are so many cases where the need is there, that they're asking citizens, Texans helping Texans, of people who have boats, who have jet skis, who have some availability to help other people. And it is unusual, because usually they say, let us take care of it. You take care of you. Let us take care of it. And in this case, they're asking for, as early as this morning, about 2 hours ago, of saying, we need the help. We need as many people as we possibly can.
There is no pride in authorship here. When you wake up in the morning and you realize that every single minute of every single hour there's going to be a downpour, your number one priority is to make sure that people are safe, and you're going to put the call out there. And I also say that, look, if there's a silver lining in any of this, it shows in moments like this that we don't care who conservatives are, who liberals are, who Republicans are, and who Democrats are. If you're watching anything right now in Houston, in that area of the country, you're seeing people helping people.
So do you have contingency plans, David, in case – and tragedies can happen anywhere. Anyway, you can get tornadoes, you can get superstorms, you can get geological shifts and earthquakes. Does every locality have to plan this stuff out?
Every locality has to plan. And one of the benefits of living in this area is you have some people would say you have too much government, too many firehouses, too many police departments. But the benefit of that is that when something happens, you have a coordinated effort that will be out there responding to whatever it is that's going on in our community. And so I don't know I know it's Harris County in Houston.
Indeed.
Yep. I'm familiar with the district attorney's office out there.
Really?
But here in the capital region, we do have the benefit of having not only local law enforcement, we have state presence, we have a strong federal presence as well, and the efforts would be coordinated.
Teresa, we were talking before the program about social media and how that's played a role in this. Many people are taking to social media if they have service, and some people do, some people don't. I was watching a report yesterday where a house was 3/4 of the way submerged and they still had air conditioning. So you don't know. But they were posting addresses of their flooded homes on Twitter and Facebook, and a lot of those were going viral. We, of course, all saw the picture of the nursing home, and they're calling for help, and if the authorities are unable to care, for them immediately because they are so inundated. And that is when
other people are stepping in. Right. Social media, I'm sure, will be a big factor here. And first and foremost, you have to give kudos to, first of all, the people at NOAA who forecasted this and provided some early warning, and then FEMA and all of the others, the government workers at every level. I used to work in the city of Boston, was part of the emergency response team, and one of the things you forget is that all of the people doing that emergency response, they have family members too. And while they're fearful of, you know, getting their family members out, they have to stay focused on this. It's a tremendously difficult task and requires enormous effort. And so there'll be a lot of money, you know, morning quarterbacking, but I'm sure that they're doing everything possible. And the response has really been tremendous. You see people coming from New Orleans. You see National Guards coming from all over the country because they have these air rescue capacity, which will be vital. But just citizens. You saw people being interviewed and on social media finding out where the need was. It was interesting, in one of the towns that was devastated first by the hurricane, some of the high school kids, they had no shelter set up, so they got into the high school. They opened it up, and then they got people to come, and they were just on their own, ran this, you know, created their emergency shelter. And they said, don't worry, we're going to clean up the high school after. Maybe it was a middle school or something. We'll clean it up after, but we felt that we needed to do something to get all of these folks into a safe place, elders and others. But I think, you know, clearly the communications on social media is so important, telling people where to go.
One of the other issues, of course, is that you have the neighboring, well, first of all, Texas, a state that did so much during Katrina to welcome people in from Katrina to take those people in for higher ground. So now you have all of these communities throughout Texas, mostly, but you look at Dallas primarily saying, well, please, we can help, we can help, we can help. And what is happening is it's getting the people there. The airspace still isn't clear, and it's still not safe for many, for boats and so forth. So there's a lot of trouble that needs to be worked out over the next couple of hours.
And getting back to your point about the president making that visit, they're going to be shutting down airspace if he in fact decides to travel there.
Yeah, I think that needs, you know, he'll go, but at the appropriate time and in the midst of the catastrophe. And this is not a bash on Trump. I mean, I remember in other cases, people have to figure out when's the right time.
Well, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
And in the middle of it, it's just not. I mean, there are enough other issues with him. But the other thing I will note is both the Mexicans have sent help and the Canadians. So in the midst of tweeting anti-NAFTA things yesterday, the Mexicans and the Canadians both have sent people to help. But really, it's, you see, and as you noted, David, the on the ground, the people helping one another.
I'm going to hold you there. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back. We'll continue. We have letters, and we will talk more about this and other issues right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have with us, let me try that again. We have with us, Teresa Bourgeois is with us. She's communications consultant. We also have the Albany County District Attorney David Soares here. Good morning, sir. And Alan Chartok, who has a handful of letters. I'll let him read a few of those, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
Okay. Peter says, good morning, panel.
Good morning.
It seems to me, I seem to recall that both United States Senators from Texas, John Cronin and Ted Cruz, spent the past 8 years bad-mouthing everything having to do with the federal government, especially federal government spending. Now, in the face of Hurricane Tropical Storm Harvey, these two consummate hypocritical senators are at the head of the line asking for federal disaster relief for Texas, FEMA help, and even military assistance for removing stranded citizens. This situation proves once again that federal tax money runs in vast quantities from blue states to red states like Texas. Go figure. Peter from Williamstown.
Well, that's true. And the current budget director, Nick Mulvaney, was one of the leaders of the Freedom Caucus who opposed a lot of this funding. And in fact, the Trump budget calls for deep cuts in FEMA budget and deep cuts in NOAA in their forecasting. And
NOAA was great, by the way.
NOAA was right on. Interestingly enough, The Trump budget calls for a $1.5 billion cut in the Commerce Department. Much of that cut is directed at NOAA, and he's asking for $1.6 billion for the wall. So you tell me which one's more important.
Mm.
Well, his timing, I think, is extremely off. I mean, given the fact that we're all witnessing what's happening right now in Texas, I don't think they're going to mount the necessary political pressure in order to achieve the wall, but also cuts to the major areas within our budget that provide for relief for people from, you know, natural disasters.
I also think that this incessant denigrating of public servants that they have been doing, this is a reminder of how invaluable their work is to our everyday lives in ways that people often just don't think about. And the public servants at all levels of government have really been the heroes in this.
President Bush, says Brian, thought the answer was to fly over New Orleans so as not to disrupt rescue efforts. And isn't he still getting flack for that? Question mark.
Yeah, but there were a lot of mistakes made on the ground prior to that, too. That
Brownie, you're doing a hell of a job.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Right. This is a different situation, and because the storm is actually still active at this point.
Yeah, it's 3 or 4 more days of rain, I think. You know,
we should note, and I do want to make this very clear, the White House has said from the very beginning that these plans were only tentative. They would be monitoring the situation to make final plans.
They want to see what the hell they're getting at. Lee says, after banning transgender folks from serving in the military and praising the fine people among the white supremacists in Charlottesville, and now pardoning Sheriff Arpaio, I suspect the president's next move to solidify his base will be a surprise return visit to the WWE SmackDown wrestling show. I hope he's not listening, they say. If you think you hope he's not listening, what do you think about us? Okay, so...
Well, you know, yeah. Certainly, look, I can tell you, reading the news, watching the news on Friday, I felt a certain way about the president's antics. And then I wake up Monday morning after having consumed the news over the weekend about the people in Texas, and I'm just not, you know, ready to continue bashing the president at this moment. My thoughts are with... what are we going to do over the next several days to make sure that we save as many lives in Texas?
Yeah. Right.
And you really just see an incredible outpouring of people from all backgrounds coming together, saving each other.
While I appreciate your tone, and I wish that it were the law of the land, David, I just want to read this one paragraph from today's New York Times. At times, Mr. Trump's tweets conveyed an unabashed excitement about the historic nature of the storm, even as it became clear that Houston and other cities faced a grinding crisis. Wow, he tweeted on Sunday morning. Now experts are calling Harvey a once-in-a-500-year flood! We have an all-out effort going and going well! An hour earlier, he noted many people are now saying that this is the worst storm hurricane they have ever seen. Good news is that we have great talent on the ground!
Or back to George Bush, Brownie, you're doing a hell of a job.
Well, I just...
One of them, when they put all the famous quotes by presidents in history, that's going to be right up there. And basically what I'm trying to say here is, I think to some degree what you just read us is reminiscent of that.
Right. Now, I will say this guy, is it John Brock?
Brock Long. Is the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, who I will say I've seen on television.
Really impressive.
Very impressive. In command, and seems to be working very well with local officials as well.
Clear, calm, and focus. He was just, I think he was nominated in June. They rushed his appointment through and got him in place as quickly as possible. He hasn't been in place very long, but he seems to be doing, you know, he seems very impressive, and he has a serious background in disaster response. But let me just say it separately on, did you need to?
No.
Press conference at the Trump Tower that was also horrifying to people because of his focus on white supremacists. As you may recall, he was actually doing a press conference. It was ostensibly about infrastructure.
Sure.
And he famously stood there, and his transportation secretary, Elaine Chao, had the long chart that she was holding. And
that's Mitch McConnell's wife.
McConnell's wife. And so lost in all of that is what, in fact, he was announcing. And what he was announcing is he was signing an executive order to change the rules to speed up infrastructure projects. Well, what does that really mean? Well, one of the things he did was roll back the flood risk management standards. And so, as I was reading yesterday, those who are experts who are concerned about flood risk management were horrified by that and think that now, in light of this storm, they're going to need to revisit that. But, you know, we talk about all the things that are getting done that it's hard to pay attention to the details of. Well, the details of what that was doing was rolling back the flood risk management standards that set standards for where you can build, can you build in floodplains or not? What kind of mitigation do you need to do in terms of the structures? So erasing those rules.
That's a wonderful point. And I think we have to start paying more attention to the executive orders that are here, that are in the rollbacks that we're seeing and we're witnessing. The place that we are right now in the opioid crisis in this country can be linked back to the rollbacks on regulations for the FDA and assisting pharmaceutical companies in getting their products to market quicker. And as a result, we really didn't have time to study the issue. And now we have, you know, this issue in front of us, this crisis. Mm-hmm. And that's very poignant. You know, I guess what I meant to say is that we have a lot of reasons to be talking about what the president did Friday evening. We have so many reasons, but I think that once we get caught up in the Donald Trump merry-go-round, we tend to focus exclusively on the Donald Trump merry-go-round, and then other conversations that we should be having mm-hmm. begin to be politicized, and then we're lost again.
But the response is beautiful, is what you're
saying. The response, you know,
horrific situation.
A horrific situation that I think will give our country an opportunity to galvanize around one another mm-hmm. and helping one another. It's like you said, you know, we have Mexicans coming here and helping us. We have Canadians helping us, not because we share a flag or even in many instances a culture. We're just doing it because we're human beings.
Because our neighbors and our friends.
Our neighbors and our friends are in trouble right now.
So is implicit in all of this a criticalness on your part, David, about the way in which we do our news?
It's not the way that we do our news. I just see this president for what he is, and I dismiss everything that he states. I dismiss everything because there's no value there.
No, see, I don't agree with you. I think I don't agree with you. And you can lock me up if you don't like this. But
free speech. I believe in people being able to express themselves.
But I don't think I agree with you because I think in the details, as Teresa is telling us and as you're telling us, in the details comes stuff that is so important to understand what's being done to the country. So so when he does a press conference and then switches, as you've indicated, he does.
We got lost in what he was actually the policy.
All the time.
But I think what you're saying is, there's a time for that. And right now, as people are, their lives are at risk and others are putting their lives at risk to save them, the moment now is to focus on that.
Let me make myself clear. I'm not suggesting that we dismiss the president's actions and what he is doing to substantively affect our country. What I'm suggesting is that in the moment, I dismiss his circus-like and what he tries to inject into our discourse because it's distraction.
But I'm sorry for interrupting, Dave, really. But if you take the consequences of what he's saying, of what Teresa's giving us and what you've given us today, and say you're taking $1.5 billion away from you're taking $1.5 billion, that has direct consequences to what's going on in Houston right now.
To be sure, I guess what I'm saying is the fact that he's plugging a controversial sheriff's book, you know, weekend.
So let's go
by the way.
Let's go to Friday night. Let's take a break, and then we'll go to Friday night. We'll go to more letters. I don't want to get behind already, so let's take a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. Right before the break, I was saying that, so let's look at Friday. Let's look at Friday at what happened. There is a Category 5 hurricane bearing down on the Gulf Coast of Texas. And while this was happening, a Sheriff Joe Arpaio was pardoned by the President of the United States. The announcement that Sebastian Gorka had left, and this was just maybe about 2 or 3 hours after the ban on the trans ban in the military was put into some more clarity by the White House. So especially the Arpaio pardon coming at a time when, to your point, David, that we should have been, slash most of the nation was, glued to find out what was happening in Texas. This is going on. So even the press had a half screen, you know, okay, this is happening here. Oh, but by the way, this is happening. And it does make it difficult. So that merry-go-round, I agree with you, but sometimes it's hard to, while that merry-go-round is going at such a high rate of speed, to completely ignore it.
I agree with you. In fact, it's a buffet of controversy. Where do you start? You know, the Arpaio pardoning to me was just offensive. It was offensive to anyone who's in law enforcement. It's offensive to anyone who believes in civil liberties. It was offensive to the people involved in our justice system. The idea that you can prosecute an individual for violating countless of others' civil liberties, and finally, you know, there was a prosecutor brave enough to take on that challenge. There was a court brave enough to hear that challenge. Jurists and the system worked. And to have someone coming in from the executive branch and just ripping apart what the judiciary and members of the executive branch had done and getting and holding Arpaio to account is just offensive.
What does it say about the rule of law? I mean, what signal does it send when the president does that?
Well, first of all, everyone who is involved in the system, right? We hold the rule of law paramount. And the idea that all of a sudden you can just come along and whimsically engage in the process. I mean, look, if it's 5 years down the line and the man has demonstrated some remorse and he's been apologetic for what he's done, and then it's a different question entirely. But to do so out of hand, even before the sentencing actually took place, which is supposed to take place in October, is just offensive. I understand the public reaction to that. I really do.
That's why presidents usually do it on the way out.
On the way out.
Right.
On the way out and after, you know, the issues have simmered. I don't think there was ever going to be a simmering for this particular sheriff, a man who has cost his county millions and millions of dollars in lawsuits, a man who basically detained people who look like me just based on a feeling, on a gut feeling.
People may not know that you happen to be of color. I just thought I'd mention that.
But the idea that you're living in the United States of America and a member of an agency that's supposed to uphold the law could stop you and detain you and then shift the burden on you to prove that you're a citizen. Right. All the while you're happening to take residence in Tent City, to me, is so offensive. And
bragging that they're run like concentration camps.
I know searching for logic in this administration from, you know, we learned this lesson 2.5 years ago. But I know looking for logic is difficult. But allow me just to interject this for a second. You come out of Charleston, you come out of that. The president comes out of that pretty beaten up as far as what is being said about his response. And then at the same time, you pardon a man who, I mean, let's face it, has done, if you look at the list of, I would recommend reading, there was a Washington Post article, the deplorable things that this man did in office, just deplorable, not just to Mexicans, but many people of color. And to be not only an early supporter of the president, but also to be someone now that the president pardons. I just, like, who thinks that's a good idea?
Well, I think members of his 36% may think that that's a great idea, but certainly you need to expand those numbers in order to successfully run for office again. So he is definitely playing to a very specific audience.
But it seems to me, and I apologize for interrupting, but it seems to me a difference between being tone deaf, which we have often talked about on this program, and an active agenda to, I mean, in this case, to honor and to compliment and commend the people who are doing these deplorable things.
Well, if, you know, to me, the pardoning didn't come as any surprise. I mean, you're talking about a president who ran for office promising to build walls so that we keep, you know, people of color out of the country. So those were dog whistles.
But these two paired together on the birther movement. I mean, remember that his friendship with Sheriff Arpaio goes back to they together focused on the birther, you know, instigated the birther movement against President Obama. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, you're absolutely right. What I'm suggesting is the idea that this comes as a surprise to the public that he did this after talking about it and hinting, as he hints during his Tuesday speech, to me was it was not a surprise.
The thing that was we have to keep in mind too is that there's a process that's supposed to be followed for pardons, and by all reports, that you know, the Justice Department is supposed to review these, and by all reports, it did not go through the Justice Department. It was just handled by the White House Counsel McGahn.
And there's also reports that that he had sought to intervene during the trial through Jeff Sessions,
which is, you tell me, you're the lawyer, highly inappropriate?
Extremely inappropriate. Which
is it more than inappropriate?
It's extremely inappropriate, and considering the fact that, you know, right now he himself is being investigated for collusion, but in addition to trying to interfere in an ongoing investigation, it just doesn't bode well, which goes to show you that there's really no one around this man's orbit who is consulting him properly. And if they are, then he certainly, you know, isn't accepting those consultations.
And while, David, and Teresa, and while we probably won't get to this, Joe, there is amazing report in the Washington Post this morning that Trump had been negotiating while he was running for president. This is a guy who had never met the Russians, don't know anything about the Russians, negotiating for a Trump Tower in downtown Moscow.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Right.
But only this weekend, and only could the events that transpired on Friday really drive that explosive story to the very bottom?
Right.
Absolutely.
It was interesting. There was a 60 Minutes piece last night on Cook County,
yes,
Illinois, Sheriff Thomas Dart.
Yes.
And I was thinking about our, you know, Sheriff Arpaio versus Sheriff Thomas Dart. Now, you may know Sheriff Thomas Dart. I had not heard of him, but I recommend...
I didn't know about him until I watched 60 Minutes.
Well, I didn't watch it, and I have a feeling a lot of other people didn't.
So,
very quickly.
Anyway, quickly, he takes a completely different view about his population. He believes that, you know, more than half of them shouldn't be there.
Oh,
and
yeah,
because
yeah,
they might have mental illness, drug addiction, or just they're there because they were too poor to pay their bonds or whatever. And so he has a whole team of people who do triage, meeting with people, like caseworkers, to try to figure out why they're there and is there someplace more appropriate. He has the warden is a psychiatrist. He has comprehensive mental health services. He said, okay, these people shouldn't be here, but while they're here, I'm going to do everything possible to give them the help and the supports they need, because I think that's the right thing for them and for the taxpayers of Cook County, because having them here is expensive. He takes a completely different approach to a more holistic approach, and it's saving money and it's saving lives.
And at the end of the day, that's what it's about. It's about reducing recidivism and at the same time maintaining public safety, not only for the people who are outside of those walls, but for also the employees who are within those walls. And speaking of good sheriffs, we have a good sheriff here in Sheriff Apple, who during his tenure has transformed what the inside of the Albany County correctional facility looks like by implementing some of those same strategies to ensure that the people who are there while they're there are receiving treatment as well as education and trades training.
Because it makes them and other people safer.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll hear from those letters and your comments, panel at WAMC.org, right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 28th of August. 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us. Let me reintroduce the panel to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here.
Hi.
Teresa Bourgeois, our communications, not our community, she's the world's communications consultant.
Oh, good.
Available for you.
Available for you.
Teresa Bourgeois, if you need communications consulting, you go to Teresa. Teresa Bourgeois is here. And the district attorney, the Albany County district attorney for the entire county of Albany, David Soares, is here. Thank you very much for being with us.
How lucky we are to
Thank
have you.
You
today.
Yes, a delight to have you with us. All right. We have a bunch of letters. Just a real quick thing, because Sarah wanted me to pass this on to you. Sarah Waduke, our wonderful producer. Keep your letters short. Keep them to the point. Don't write in more than once a day. Don't include links. Don't use abbreviations. Proofread your emails before you send. Why are we telling you this? Because most of you have violated the rules this morning. Okay.
The guidelines.
Go ahead, Alan.
All right, here we go. Robin writes on Arpeo. There's a difference between being surprised and horrified. Most of us are no longer surprised by Trump's actions. If we cease to be shocked and horrified at his actions, which undermine our democracy, then we are in big trouble. And Dan says, I've known hundreds in capital letters of Sheriff Arpeo's, and he's part of the greatest generation of haters. But Trump can pardon whoever he wants to. It's tough if you don't like it. I wish this radio station would fall in line and support our, capital O-U-R, president. WAMC would be saying this if the witch had won. Again, I could care less if you read this. I have to send.
I support our Constitution and our democracy.
All right. And David says, obstruction of justice. There's a report out this morning that Trump tried to get Justice Department to intervene in the Arpaio case months ago. Is there the possibility of an obstruction of justice charge for Mueller related to this? I give it to David Soares. What do you think?
Well, I can tell you right now that being in Mr. Mueller's position, I'm sure just when he thought that he was starting to hone in on one particular charge, there's like additional charges that are coming, forcing him to begin his investigation in other areas all over again. So this is a target that just continues to move, and he'll probably need more prosecutors, and there'll probably be an announcement of increasing his staff over the next couple of weeks.
Well, Mr. District Attorney, I wanted to ask you this question because you are in a position to know. It's clear they're going after Manafort and Flynn. Now, the theory by many people is that they want them so that they'll flip on the president. The question, or otherwise known in the last letter as our president. So is it possible? But what I worry about is that those guys are going to be the fall guys in all of this and that nothing more will get done.
A good prosecutor is always going to want to get to the root of the problem. And he's going to go wherever the evidence takes him. Right now, the evidence has taken him. The clearest path to a successful prosecution would be Flynn and Manafort. But you have a whole host of issues that involve not only those two, but you also have the sons and you have Mr. Kushner.
And you have the president who said he didn't do anything in Russia. He didn't know anything about Russia. Now we find out he wants to build a hotel. He was negotiating to build a hotel there.
Exactly. And so this case is not one that just it's not a simple open and shut case where you're investigating the misdeeds of a campaign. They could have gone into this investigation believing that. However, if they've turned a number of stones, they may have uncovered so much more. So he, you know, as far as the Democrats are concerned, I wouldn't be looking for closure, you know, anytime soon, because I do think that this is a complicated and a very broad investigation.
So if it's a broad investigation, I'm fascinated, David, by what you're saying here. If it's a broad investigation, can it be done in stages? In other words, we could say, okay, this is what we have right now, and we're going to make a couple of indictments or grand juries or stuff like that. Or do they have to wait to the end?
Usually, you know, in the federal system where you know, they have time on their side and resources on their side, they're going to spend the time to turn over every stone and see what's underneath the stones. Then once they compile their case and they see it in its totality, they're really going to whittle it down to make it the most presentable, most understandable set of facts for public consumption as well as for judicial expediency. They're going to want to make the best case, the clearest case that they can.
Chris says, why no mention of climate? Dear panelists, Texas experiences a 500-year storm, in quotes. Why are we not hearing about the connections to climate change? The science behind the storm is conspicuously missing in the reporting. Please explain. Chris from Troy. It's a tough one, right? Because we've had these storms in the past. I remember once I was a little, I wasn't born yet, but 38, I think there was a Fire Island storm that almost knocked out. You know, there was almost no more Fire Island. So it isn't as if, I'm not defending it, but I'm simply saying the history of major weather events has not precluded these things.
But when you have 100-year floods and 500-year floods at
every couple of years,
yeah, every couple of years, then it does become more concerning. And also, I don't want to put words in your mouth, sir, but you have made the point that right now we're in the middle of a situation of trying to help those who are on the top of their homes and need help. I think there'll be plenty of time to start talking about the environmental issues that brought us to this point, which. Even in the NOAA coverage and from the statements they have made and talking about the warming waters that have allowed this storm to incubate for so long to move across at that record pace are, I believe, at least seem to be setting the stage for exactly that, making that case.
Let me be clear. I believe that this storm, along with all of the other storms that continue to hit our country and destroy our infrastructure, I believe it has something to do with climate change.
Yep.
I think to begin having that conversation right now politicizes the issue, and it distracts from what the main issue should be right now, which is helping people.
Except now, David, people are paying attention.
Absolutely. And so the trick is, how do you thread that needle with helping individuals who need to be helped, helping an entire region of our country that need to be helped, without delving into the dangerous political pitfalls that will then inspire people who should be making decisions? Like right now, you have a senator who's going to be sitting there saying to himself, look, we should be voting to increase funding for relief. And you're going to have pressure on that senator from special interests that say, well, if you vote this way to increase relief, you're making an admission about climate change. That's the danger of having the climate change discussion right now.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. You know, I thought about this in preparation for the show. Is today the day to be talking about, you know, the reasons for the flooding, or is it really a Thursday story or next week or whatever? But certainly climate is intertwined in this. There was a great piece that I read yesterday. ProPublica teamed with the Texas Tribune in December and did a piece called Boomtown Floodtown on Houston. And they basically anticipated this would happen, both if you combine climate change issues, as Joe said, the warming of the oceans and such, which then holds more rain, and then the sprawl, the urban sprawl in Houston, where a lot of the wetlands have now been built. So there's more concrete, less natural, you know, nature's sponge. They basically took away nature's sponge. And they built the roads. So the roads, one of the reasons they say, why aren't people why didn't they have people evacuate? Well, one of the concerns, as I read, is that they're only about three ways out.
And so
a lot of these issues, planning, design, plus climate change, all have to be factored in.
Albert writes us, flood assistance by New York State. The governor has offered flood assistance, personal helicopters, et cetera. I wonder if Texas did or will in the future do the same for us when we get hit. Many Southern congressional representatives did not do so after Sandy. Sent from my very own fingers, says Albert.
You know, Albert, I don't think we do good things for people with the expectation that they're going to do them back for us. I think we just do the good things for other people because other people need help.
Yeah, but David, the point is well taken, you know. I mean, is this reciprocal? I've made the argument that a storm like this begs for reciprocalness on the part of everybody in America, but then it works the other way too.
But I think there's two different things. There's the response, meaning the people from the regionally here, from the Red Cross going down to help, the National Guard from New York State going down to help in the immediate crisis. That's one response, and we see that overwhelmingly now from all over. The second is the one that comes later, which is the, you know, did they or did they not vote for Sandy relief, and therefore will New Yorkers? And a number of New York congressmen said, even though you didn't, we will, you know, work to provide support for Texas. But I think there's a legislative response, but then there's an immediate emergency response, and those folks are going in droves, as they should. And also, each one of us, as Barack Obama, you know, pointed out in his tweet yesterday, not only the first responders and others can go there and help, but all of us can help by supporting things like the Red Cross or Save the Children or other groups.
More letters.
Charles writes, Ellen, Charlie from Pine Bush. As a Crisis Corps volunteer in Manila, Philippines during Typhoon Ondoy, 2009, and UMCOR in New York State during Irene and Sandy, 2011-12, I find it counterproductive to label these events 100-year storms. This may have been applicable before the era of climate change, but no more are these estimates accurate. The hotter the oceans get, the more severe and frequent these storms will be. FEMA will become more important than its parent DHS. Insurance companies will start declaring cities like New Orleans uninhabitable and uninsurable. Cassandra says, Joe Arpaio, hello, panel.
Hello.
My biggest concern with the pardon is that people lower on the crime scale will not flip on the higher-ups because Donald Trump basically nodded that they will be pardoned if they keep quiet. Quite scary situation we have. Thank you, Cassandra, from Ashley Falls. Let's see. Namaste.
Namaste.
I'm so sorry. I do this all the time.
That's right.
Namaste.
Apologize. Jared Kushner's visit to Israel to discuss peace seems a bit dubious considering nothing new is really happening in Israel. I wonder if he's also looking at a new home for him and his family to avoid the fall of the Trump empire. Israel has no extradition, so it seems like a safe harbor. Maybe even dad along. Depends on how much Mueller finds. Thanks from Paul. But yeah, but Israel has made exceptions in its past.
Well, I think they needed to do some shoring up post the white supremacist Nazi remarks. They needed to do some shoring up with the Israelis, and that's why he went there. But who am I to say? That's my assumption.
Interesting.
Why he went there.
Christine says, Houston, great to hear our arch enemies are stepping up to help the people of Houston, and Trump is still an idiot in chief. Rain bombs are happening every year. See the inconvenient truth, too. Brian says, Texas, first, I wish everyone dealing with the flooding in Texas well. Second, I hope the secessionists learn from this experience. This would be a lot harder without the federal government and their, quote, black helicopters. And Susan says, the president's visit to Texas in an interview in CBS this morning, Governor Abbott and President Trump would come Tuesday, not to Houston, but to the hurricane-ravaged coastal areas. He seems to indicate that right now Houston had other things to worry about, not to defend Trump, but this would be the best thing for him to do. Go there offering help and support, but not get in the way of major disaster in the active flooding areas. I'm hoping Texans will come out of this as believers in our need to deal with global warming. And Susan in New Lebanon. That's it.
And remember, of course, Houston is the heart of the petrochemical industry, certainly in the U.S. and probably around the world. I'm not sure if it's around the world, but certainly they're part of the oil petrochemical industry in the U.S.
All right, let's move on to some other topics as we just have about 5 minutes left of our time together for the panel this morning. We mentioned it very fleetingly, but there is the fact that Sebastian Gorka has left the White House. Like many of these departures, we don't know if he was fired or whether he quit or whether it was a combination of both, but he's gone. And Sebastian Gorka, a national security aide whose hardline views on immigration and terrorism caused discord inside and outside the White House, is the latest official to exit President Trump's administration. Gorka told the Associated Press Friday that he had resigned from his position. A White House official, however, said Gorka did not resign but no longer works at the White House. That official was not authorized to discuss the matter publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. There was a great article in the Washington Post on Saturday in which a high-level White House official said when it came down to the time of the decision that nobody was sure what he did.
Well, I think what he did was stoke the flames around issues such as terrorism and national security. I'm pretty sure that's what he was there to do. I'm not sure that he had any useful function or purpose in that administration.
This is a terrible man. There's no other way to look at it.
No.
His history is extraordinary. His utterances and the things he's said and his associations in the past, it's extraordinary that guy could have been in the White House in the first place.
We were talking about this earlier in the program about, you know, the importance of someone with a steady hand to remain within the White House to keep some of this going on. But I hope with these defections and leaving and people leaving, Bannon leaving, Gorka leaving, that it's not forgotten of who these people were and why they were put in that position in the first place.
But even to use the word defections in the case of these people, first of all, both of them were fired. And that's different from defecting, right? I mean, defecting means you're leaving on your own free will. Being fired is another whole thing. And the only reason that happens is when their misdeeds become so apparent that a president with a 33 or 34% rating has to say, okay, we can't carry this load anymore.
It's really no surprise when a campaign people that were useful and providing a function during a campaign, it's no surprise when they transition into the actual operation of an administration. What is shocking is that this particular individual managed to do that, in addition to Steve Bannon. The characters that have found residency over the past 6 months in this administration is, just like you said, shocking. But eventually, because I believe that these particular individuals were out there engaging in more self-promotion than they were actually involved in policymaking or serving the country.
And that's why I use the word defection, because not even defection between leaving the White House, but a defection of whatever the policy of the Trump administration is slash or was, they were then speaking out against him. They were calling up New Yorker reporters and screaming and yelling. They were going to other Bannon's, what was it, National Review that he went to, different places that they were calling, and Gorka most recently going after the comments regarding Afghanistan.
I see your point.
So there was a defection of whatever the line was within the administration that they were stepping away from.
I think we had heard about the battles within the administration, the internal battles and the struggles to either have the president moderate or continue his, you know, rightward plunge. And I think that what you're seeing now is that at least the moderates were having some effect, because if you see the number of people that have left over what I call the newest presidential Survivor series, every Friday there's someone being voted off the island. I think we're seeing that, you know, at least the people that are trying to moderate the president are having some success by getting these people out.
But not in his public utterances when he goes to do the next thing. Where's the next one going to be?
Missouri.
Yeah.
In Missouri.
Well, he better not do that Wednesday in Missouri. I mean, it would be so unseemly.
Really?
Oh, it would be absolutely unseemly.
I don't mean to.
No, I know. But
what has kept him from doing unseemly things?
there are people drowning in southern Texas right now. There are people trapped in their houses, in their attics, drowning. There are senior citizens in wheelchairs with water up to their elbows, and it's no time for a political rally. But can I say about the Gorka leaving? I mean, I think that he's not going far. He's going to Breitbart. He's teaming up again with Bannon. I think he'll still have the ear of the president. I'm more concerned about, if you talk about key national security people leaving and the impact it will have on the United States. On Friday, Foreign Policy magazine had an article about what they call Black Friday, where several key, top, longtime State Department people left the State Department. And while I think it's great that Gorka left, I think we have a really serious problem where these people with decades of experience and in diplomacy are now being urged to leave, or you know, being either pushed out or leaving because of deep frustration. And that is not getting, you know, rightfully Gorka gets attention, but that is a serious problem to our country.
We are out of time. My thanks to everyone who took part in this morning's broadcast. That includes Teresa Bourgeois.
Donate.
To
the Red Cross, Save the Children, whomever.
Alan Chartok. David Soares, great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to put the pressure on you. Cause I don't like doing it off the air because then it becomes awkward. But if I ask you on the air and put you on the spot, will you come back?
I will come back.
Excellent.
When I'm asked.
Okay. Well, all right. What are you doing tomorrow?
See you tomorrow.
All right. We'll be back after this.